Thank you. Thank you. So as you can tell by the title, I'm going to be talking about a lot of different things that are seemingly separate and not related to each other at all. But throughout this talk, I'll try to motivate a connection between all these different areas and how this connection might actually help in understanding exactly how echoes are generated in gravity, in quantum gravity theories, which are holographic. So I'll begin by talking a little bit about the background and context, and then I'll pose a question, and then I'll talk about some progress that I have made along with Dr. Afshorty in answering this question. And most of this talk will be based on this paper on archive. So the black hole information paradox is essentially can be summed up as asking whether black hole evolution, like black hole evaporation, whether it's a unitary process. So if you apply quantum field theory to a standard black hole background, it predicts that the black hole will eventually evaporate, and it'll evaporate into thermal radiation. So if you imagine that you started with some matter in a pure state and then collapsed into a black hole, you'd essentially be saying that a pure state has evolved into a mixed state. And this violates unitarity. You can't unitarily evolve a pure state into a mixed state. So this leads to a question or conundrum which has plagued theoretical physics for many decades. And it's the question of whether a complete theory of quantum gravity should violate unitarity or not. And depending on who you ask, some people will say yes, some people will say no. But it seems that if you consider the holographic principle, the answer seems to be that there isn't information loss. So the holographic principle suggests that gravitational systems in subregions in space-time can be mapped to some other system on the boundary of that subregion. And the most well understood realization of the holographic principle comes from the ADS-CFT correspondence. So the basic idea is that gravitational systems in asymptotically anti-De Sitter spaces can be understood in terms of a conformal field theory on the boundary of ADS. So this is essentially the picture. You have anti-De Sitter in the interior, and this interior is usually referred to as the bulk. And the boundary of the space-time is a conformal boundary, and time is evolving upward. So how exactly does this correspondence work? Well, the basic idea is that different CFT states would give rise to different bulk geometries that are asymptotically ADS. So for example, the canonical example is the vacuum state of the CFT would correspond to just empty pure ADS. And the matter fields in the bulk are dual to some operators on the conformal boundary. And information about these fields in the bulk can be understood in terms of correlation functions on the boundary and vice versa. Okay, so the question we pose now is, does ADS-CFT resolve the information paradox? And the answer is sort of a yes and a no, in the sense that if you really believe the ADS-CFT correspondence and it's claimed that gravitational systems in ADS can be mapped to non-gravitational systems, which are CFTs, which manifestly respect unitarity, then you would expect that evolution of quantum fields in a black hole would respect unitarity. But this is not enough. I mean, because you can do the same calculations that Hawking did in an asymptotically flat space, and it's not clear just by doing these calculations, where exactly Hawking's calculation goes wrong. Furthermore, It's not clear how the unitarity would be restored directly from the bulk perspective. So if you really want to understand this, then you have to have a very good understanding of how the bulk emerges from the CFT dynamics. And currently, this understanding is incomplete. So, however, there are quantum information theoretic considerations of black holes from quantum information theoretic perspective suggest that in order to restore unitarity in the bulk, you should modify the near horizon region. And examples of this are the fuzzball picture and firewall picture, and maybe something even more exotic like these exotic compact objects that are discussed. So we have this idea in holography that you can map a gravitational system to a unitary non-gravitational system. So if, and we also have this a sense that there should be some sort of near horizon modification in order to actually restore unitarity. So in that sense, there should be some sort of quantum system or holographic CFT state that exhibits echoes. We can ask if there is such states. And we can also ask what should we actually look for in the CFT state? What kind of things should we calculate to determine whether this CFT state is dual to some sort of black hole with a modified horizon? So a good place to start is just to consider how echoes would be generated in the bulk. And to do this, you could just consider scalar wave equation in a Schwarzschild ADS background. And you can show that the radial part of the solution looks like this Schrodinger type equation. And with this effective potential V. So most people here are aware of what the effective potential looks like for asymptotically flat black holes, but for asymptotically ADS black holes, it looks different. So there are two length scales for the asymptotically ADS black hole geometry. That's the ADS radius, which is related to the negative cosmological constant, and the black hole horizon radius. So there's two distinct types of black holes in ADS. There are these large ADS black holes where the horizon radius is much larger than the ADS radius. And there are these smaller black holes which RH is much smaller than L. So if you actually work out what the effective potential looks like, you'll see that for very small ADS black holes, it doesn't look much different from an asymptotically flat black hole if you just look at the near horizon.
Did you know that this is kind of the reverse of what everyone else has been showing, that the horizon is on the right?
Yeah, I'm plotting negative R star here. So, yeah. So this is negative infinity in this direction. Yeah, it's a bit awkward. And the idea behind echoes when you want to model them using GR is you would place some kind of membrane here that would reflect perturbations. And essentially the mechanism behind how these echoes would be produced in these kinds of space-times would more or less be the same. You would have some perturbation bouncing off of this membrane and it would just bounce back and forth. Now the dissipation in this system is actually not going to occur unless this membrane is actually dissipative. So somehow this membrane, maybe you could think of it as some sort of quantum system itself that can actually absorb some of the energy, because you can't have energy actually leaking out because of this divergence at zero, which is actually where the conformal boundary sits. So we can ask some questions about what does the time scale look like for these echoes that are generated in this kind of potential. So we look at spherically symmetric metrics just for simplicity of this form, and we look at the echo time in the geometric optics approximation, And this is just the double the radial, the tortoise coordinate distance between the membrane, which sits a delta r away from rh, to some turning point, which will depend on the frequency of the perturbation that you're considering. So usually the RT, you would, and for an asymptotically flat black hole, you would set as somewhere around the angular momentum barrier, the local maximum. So you would, for asymptotically flat black holes, you would set it to about here. So, but for very large ADS black holes, there's not like a clear place to put this. So you can actually integrate all the way to this barrier. And what we'll actually find later on is that it doesn't really matter how far you integrate to, it's not going to affect the echo time much. So what we're going to do is delta r will be the coordinate radial distance of where we think that the horizon is being modified. And we're going to set that to a proper Planck length from the horizon. So this is the condition that we want to satisfy. And to leading order, you can show that delta r is then given by LP square over beta, where beta is the inverse Hawking temperature. And you actually get this from doing a expansion of the integrand near the horizon to first order. So the Planck length now gives you a natural perturbative parameter, and you can do an expansion of that integral in the Planck length. And what you'll find is this kind of expression. So the leading order contribution comes from the near horizon. So this is can be thought of as the amount of time that the perturbation spends in the Rindler region. So this is the region where you can approximate the geometry of the horizon on a small patch as a Rindler patch. And the second term, this becomes important when you have near extremal black holes. So in the case when beta goes to infinity. So just for simplicity, if you're not considering near extremal black holes, you can just ignore this term. And the third term, this term represents essentially the amount of time you spend outside the Rindler region. So, and you can show that this term for very large ADS black holes is bounded. So you can, you're going to do an integral from some point outside the Rindler region to all the way to some turning point. And you can send that turning point to infinity and still have a finite result. Okay, so what we're interested in here is the leading order contribution to the echo time. And you can show that for very small ADS black holes, this gives you an echo time that looks like beta over 2 pi log of the entropy of the black hole. And for very large ADS black holes, you can show that the echo time looks like beta over 2 pi log of L square over LP. So in this case, it looks like the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a small cell of characteristic length L on the horizon. So what I want to focus on is the large ADS black holes, so this expression. So in ADS CFT, it's known that ADS black holes in the bulk are dual to very strongly coupled large N gauge theories on the boundary at the same temperature as the Hawking temperature. And in particular, this ratio L over LP is actually related to N squared, so the rank of the gauge group on the boundary, which sort of measures the number of effective number of degrees of freedom on your boundary theory. And in this case, if you use this, then you can actually rewrite T echo as beta over 2 pi log n squared. So why is this fact interesting? So to understand that, I need to talk a little bit about entanglement disruption for the thermal field double state. So the thermofield double state is essentially takes the eigenstates of some CFT and writes and takes two CFTs with and writes them like this, and the geometric interpretation in the bulk is that this is dual to a two-sided eternal black hole, a large ADS black hole. And you can think of these states and L as living on this left conformal boundary, and the states and R living on the right conformal boundary. And one of the features of this space-time is that the exteriors are connected by a non-transversible wormhole. And this wormhole is actually the entanglement. So you can also see that this state is actually entangled. If you trace out all the left modes, you'll get some thermal state on the right and vice versa. So this is a highly entangled state, and it shows entanglement between the left and right degrees of freedom. And this is from the ADS CFT dictionary. This is pictured as this entanglement is manifested in terms of this non-transversible wormhole that connects these two geometries. So you can ask you can ask how much entanglement there is between the left and right degrees of freedom. And one way to quantify that is to consider the mutual information between the left and right boundary. And this is, so S is the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix of the left region, and the same goes for the right, and S, L, and L union R is basically for the entropy of both sides.
Should that be a minus sign on that?
Yeah, I think that's supposed to be a minus sign. Yeah, it's a typo.
Okay.
So there's also a way to actually compute this. There's a geometric way of computing this using the Ryutaki-Nagi formula. So the basic idea is that your CFT would live, you pick a Cauchy slice on your CFT, and then you pick a subregion on the CFT. And then you can ask, okay, what is the entanglement between the subregion R and its complement? And this, the answer to this turns out to be an area of an extremal surface, a codimension two extremal surface in the bulk, which is homologous to this boundary region and is also anchored. It shares the boundary of the CFT. And it's given by this formula. So you calculate this surface, and then you take the area of that surface and divide by 4gn. So it's reminiscent to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for a black hole. And indeed, if you actually take L and R to be the entire left and right regions, then you'll actually find, since it's a pure state, this piece will be zero, and these two terms will add to two times the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black holes on the two sides. Okay, so now we want to ask the question of what happens to the entanglement, the mutual information between the left and right side when you perturb the field theory by some operator that's localized on the right CFT. So the way to think about this from the bulk point of view is that you can think of creating a particle close to the boundary and allow it to propagate toward the black hole. So let me just quickly go back to this picture. So I could apply some operator at this time, and this would represent some particle that's propagating toward this horizon. Now, if I send the T, if I choose a T that is sending this operator insertion further and further back, the blue shifted energy relative to the T equals zero slice becomes very large. and effectively you end up with sort of a shock wave. And the back reacted geometry looks something like this. So this is the Penrose diagram for it. So you can sort of see that the region that's inaccessible, that sort of connects the two exteriors, has lengthened. And this is actually represented by the increase in...
The shockwave, is that the line that goes across?
Yeah, so the shockwave goes from the bottom right mm-hmm. of this all the way here. And it generates this discontinuity in this one of these Kruskal coordinates. Yes. And yes, so you can use the RT prescription in this shockwave geometry and compute what the mutual information is. So basically, it's when you do the calculation, you will see that as I send the T, the time at which I inserted the operator, to, if it's larger than beta over 2 pi log of S over delta S, the mutual information goes to zero. So it's where S is the entropy of the black hole and delta S is the change in entropy of the black hole due to this perturbation in the bulk, which is sourced by this operator. So, okay. So now we can ask so we're free to choose what delta S is. And we can ask, okay, what's the smallest reasonable choice for delta S? And most people would say that the smallest choice of delta S should be correspond to throwing one Hawking quanta into the black hole. So that corresponds to a delta S equal to 1, and then you find that tau equals beta over 2 pi log S. But there's also perhaps another choice you could make. And that choice comes from the idea that you shouldn't be able to measure any kind of change in a geometry that sort of shifts the geometry on lengths that are smaller than a proper Planck length. So in the context of the black hole geometry, we would suggest that you should not, the smallest reasonable perturbation should actually shift the horizon by no less than a proper Planck length. And when you choose this for delta S, can actually show that that the tau in which the mutual information goes to zero equals to the T echo. So this result, this one. Okay, so why is this interesting?
This is called the scrambling.
Called the scrambling time. Yeah, in literature, this is referred to as a scrambling time. Okay. So why is this important? Why have I talked about the disruption of entanglement? Well, it's because it seems a lot of studies have shown that in order to cross the horizon in a drama-free way, the modes within the interior of the black hole and the exterior need to be entangled in a particular way. So just to get a sense of like how this works, you can consider the horizon, the geometry that's close to the horizon. And we know that for non-extremal black holes, that can be approximated by a Rindler spacetime. So this is the same near horizon geometry can also be described in terms of a constantly accelerating observer in Minkowski space. So if you consider the vacuum state in Minkowski space in Rindler coordinates, then you can actually show that the vacuum state in Rindler coordinates in a flat space-time actually takes the form of the thermofield double state. And the thermofield double state actually contains very specific correlations which actually leave the vacuum state regular at the horizon. So these accelerated observers see this effect, this apparent horizon. They have like this wedge that they can access. And we can sort of think of that as sort of the horizon of the black hole. And and the point is that if you look at the entanglement between the left and right wedges, there's a very specific type of entanglement you need in order for the quantum fields to be regular at the horizon. So why is this interesting? It's because the thermal field, so if you were only living on one side, on one of the wedges, which is the case for an observer that just sits outside of the horizon, then you would see essentially a thermal density matrix when you trace out the left-hand side. And this thermal density matrix is essentially, you can sort of think of it like the density matrix for the Hawking radiation. And the other side you can think of as a purification of that radiation, which leaves the total state pure in the entire space-time. And so it's known that if you have a mixed state, the purification of any mixed state is not unique. So if you can choose any different types of purifications, and those different types of purifications will correspond to different types of entanglement between the left and right wedge. And in general, if you just arbitrarily choose some purification, you're not going to see regular quantum fields at the horizon. And this is sort of like the argument that there's a presence of a sort of a firewall near the horizon. So it really has something to do with the entanglement of fields close to the horizon. Okay. So this is sort of the picture that I want to propose. So if you start with a black hole that's recently collapsed from a pure state, it's near horizon. If you look at the vacuum state, if you look at the state of the quantum fields near the horizon, it should look like the thermal field double. Now we'll introduce a perturbation and like far away outside the Rindler region. And it will take T echo over 2 time to get within a proper Planck length of the horizon. Now, as this perturbation approaches the horizon, the perturbation contains some kind of information, and it will get scrambled by the black hole. And the effect of the scrambling is to destroy these very delicate correlations that allow for the smooth crossing of the horizon. So the fact that T echo and this mutual information disruption timescale are of the same, are the same to leading order, it suggests that when you scramble this information, you'll get some sort of modification to the horizon, some kind of firewall, or maybe something even different than that. But it's possible it will generate some sort of modifications near the horizon, and it is possible that these types of modifications could result in the reflection of perturbations, which would give rise to echoes. So the picture that I've sort of painted here is that we can think of scrambling as a sort of a mechanism that would generate echoes. So now the question is that, okay, we have some sort of qualitative picture. How can we actually test this in a more rigorous way? So to test it, I need to talk about quantum chaos. So chaos is a fairly generic feature of all thermal systems. And classically, it diagnoses the sensitivity of initial conditions. Yeah?
Can I ask a question from the previous?
Yeah.
I don't really follow the logic.
So the idea is that if I was just an observer, just look from the outside, and I introduced a perturbation near the boundary, it would take a T echo over 2 amount of time to reach within a proper Planck length. And to actually cross the horizon actually takes an infinite amount of time. But the point I want to make is that you don't actually know what's happening at the horizon until you wait a very long time. But since the T, if you But at the same time, the T echo is also comparable to the scrambling time. So in that sense, as this perturbation comes toward the horizon, the information gets scrambled, and it'll generate modifications to the near horizon geometry as it's coming in. And it's possible that these modifications will actually cause this perturbation, some of the information actually just come back out.
This is causing what?
Some part of the perturbation could just bounce back because of this sort of modification. Some of it will be absorbed and some of it will come back. And because like in the firewall paradigm, it's believed that the firewall is at the horizon. But if it was at the horizon, an observer far away would never actually detect the presence of it. You would actually have to fall in and actually experience it. You couldn't actually know that there was a firewall if you were just standing at infinity. You'd have to wait an infinite amount of time. Yeah. So but the fact that you're scrambling within an echo time, it means that maybe that there's actually already a structure before the horizon, and that could allow for the reflection.
The structure is caused by the perturbation.
Yes, that's right.
And the perturbation can be arbitrarily small and still cause.
Yes. Yes.
So I guess I think your thesis, as far as I understand, is you're saying that you need perfect entanglement between the two sides to have for a regular horizon, but then we know that the entanglement is destroyed within the scrambling time. So when the entanglement is destroyed, then you just destroy the horizon. Because
the horizon and perfect entanglement
are synonymous. So I think that's
the thesis. When
you're scrambling, you destroy the entanglement, and you destroy the horizon. So that's.
So entanglement is destroyed.
But if you have like an infalling shockwave, then entanglement is destroyed.
Yeah.
And then he's saying that the entanglement is destroyed and the horizon is destroyed as well.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of the connection here, right?
Yeah.
So you're saying like involving signals destroys the horizon geometries.
Yes.
But you know the shock is this plane and presumably quote unquote firewall is on this plane.
Mm.
So are they different?
Well, okay, so this picture so you're saying a firewall is like here.
Which one is firewall?
Okay, so this is the shockwave.
Yeah.
And the firewall would be like here.
So what you're saying is, shock wave change the black horizon or destroy the horizon? Change the.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear what it means to actually change the horizon in this sense. I mean.
Yeah, in the slide you mentioned change of the horizon, right?
Yes.
The log s over delta s. It means change of the horizon, not destroying the horizon, right?
Yeah, so the delta S is a measure of the strength of the perturbation on that comes
delta
in.
Delta S is change in entropy.
Yeah, it's the change in entropy of the black hole after the.
That means change of the entropy, change of the black hole, the area. That is
yes, the change in the area, yeah. So it's the change of the area.
So I think the question, I mean, this is the classical picture. Of course, this doesn't show any quantum effects,
yes.
Right? But the statement that this shows that the entanglement between the two sides is destroyed within some time, right? And then that, I guess, everybody.
But this statement can be more precise in a sense like there is a mode that is evolving. I'm looking at the outgoing mode on my side. Then if scrambling is happening, we can vigorously prove assuming unitarity. And the scrambling that this outgoing mode is completely decoupled from the other side. That is the statement we can put. Now, that is not enough to show that the firewall is nothing because it's the point. I feel that the point is that this outgoing mode is compatible with other modes. that is newly created because of the shock or perturbation we added. So it is true that the left and right entanglement are destroyed, but that's not enough to say that there must be a firewall.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I think that's it's certainly another proof, but it's kind of a guess.
I guess. Right.
And I think the only observation is that the timer scale is the same, but yeah, it's just a geometric experiment. Right. That if you had near horizon structure, you get this echo time and the timer scale for destroying the entanglement is also the same time. So but I mean you're right that I don't think you can prove it.
I think that it's not entirely clear that after a scrambling time you can really trust that the bulk is actually like can be described semi-classically within a Planck length of the horizon. I don't think that's entirely clear.
Do you think there's a semi-classical description after the scrambling time?
Depends in a sense, but in the regime we are looking at, I think it's yes.
Okay.
And but I mean, after computing it would be difficult, but I mean, assuming that black hole equilibrates.
Because my understanding is that these calculations are done under the assumption they don't do the calculation directly in the field theory side. They actually say that okay, this field theory is dual to some semi-classical geometry. Maybe we can talk about it.
Later. After the scrambling time, we can compute everything. Right? After the scrambling time, we lose control. But in order to make this statement, all we need to know is the out of time that the correlator decays to small value, and we really don't. It's normal systems. We don't really think out of time that the correlator is defined.
Yeah.
Which actually might be wrong in some situation where this equals might apply that the
course. So I guess maybe he's gonna talk about that.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to talk about, yeah. Okay, so so how can we test it? So yeah, so now I want to bring you to the quantum chaos story. And so chaos is a generic feature for thermal systems. And to classically diagnose chaos in a system, you can consider the Poisson bracket between x at t and p at zero, and that's equal to how much the x at t is changing when you change x at zero. So we say that a system is chaotic if this goes like if it grows exponentially, and this coefficient lambda l is called the Lyapunov exponent. And in a similar fashion, one says that a quantum system exhibits quantum chaos if the commutator square between a thermal state also grows exponentially. And again, you have this Lyapunov exponent. The two comes from squaring this. Okay, so it's known that ADS black holes are dual to certain thermal holographic CFT states with temperature T equals TH. And so you can calculate these out of time order correlators under the assumption that you have this holographic description. And when you do that, you'll find that the commutator square exhibits exponential growth between the dissipation time and the scrambling time T star. And the dissipation time is of something like beta, and T star would, for a large n theory, would be beta over 2 pi log n squared. So you can show that for these systems that would be dual to black holes in ADS, that the Lyapunov exponent actually saturates to the Lyapunov exponent equals to 2 pi over beta. And it's been argued in various works that this is actually an upper bound on the Lyapunov exponent for systems with larger degrees of freedom. And black holes saturate this bound. So this is the picture. So initially, for t smaller than the dissipation time, the commutator square is of order 1 over n. And then there is a region of Lyapunov growth between Td and T star, so around here. And after that, it's believed that this should saturate to some order 1 constant for times greater than the scrambling time. So, okay, yeah, where the scrambling time is beta log n square. And the behavior up here is actually governed by the quasi-normal modes of the dual black hole. Okay, so the idea is as follows. So if you do have echoes, and they're, you can think of them as sort of a symptom of this modified horizon, which allows for the partial reflection of perturbations. And this happens essentially on the same time scale as the echoes. So if you were to hand me a state and ask me to calculate something that would allow me to diagnose the existence of this modified horizon, then what I would say is that you should calculate the commutator square. And I would claim that the Lyapunov exponent should be smaller than 2 pi over beta, so it shouldn't saturate, because these types of objects wouldn't necessarily have horizons. And after the scrambling time, the rule region should actually, you should see some echoes before this sort of saturates to a constant. So, okay.
Why the Lyapunov exponent must?
Well, my understanding of the saturation of the Lyapunov exponent is that it saturates because there's a horizon there, and this has to do with the scattering of high energy particles off the horizon. But if you're scattering slightly away from the horizon, if there's something there, then you shouldn't expect this. You shouldn't expect this bound to saturate anymore. You should expect something slightly smaller.
I was thinking of massless modes,
but I don't see any reason why you couldn't consider mass modes.
So if it's massive, visually there is some correction, something more.
Yeah, but I think this would also be true for massless modes, I think.
Even in a formal black hole with horizon?
No, I think if a black hole has a horizon in the sense that it's described by, you know, the usual Einstein.
These calculations, so if there are massless and there are some corrections, it has to make the black hole.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so yeah, so these would be the two conditions that I would be looking for when I diagnose some CFT state. I would calculate the out of time order correlator, and then I would check for these two things. And if these two things are satisfied, then I would actually say that this is a candidate state for these exotic compact objects, and this would provide some kind of holographic description for them. So just to summarize, so we considered the timescale for echoes for asymptotically ADS black holes, and we showed that for perturbations that shift the horizon by a proper Planck length, you can identify the echo and scrambling timescales. So I suggested that scrambling would generate some sort of modified structure near the horizon, which might generate modifications that would allow for the reflection of perturbations. And I suggested that we can diagnose. So I suggest that if you hand me a CFT state that you think is going to be dual to some geometry that you should calculate the out of time order correlator, and you should expect that the Lyapunov exponent is smaller than 2 pi over beta, and you should also see some echoes after a scrambling time. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions?
So actually, in ADS space time, what I expected is this. So it's, you have echoes, and then you echo is generated by the sketched horizons. Right? And then in the ADS, there is a potential for infinity. So if you go, the echo goes to infinity, then it might be reflected there.
Yes.
By the over. I don't see any effects of that in your...
Oh, yes. Okay. So, yes. So you're right that the mechanism behind generating these echoes is because you're bouncing off this, at least, yeah, for this one. Yes, that's right. But the claim is that the largest contribution to the echo time actually comes from the time it's spent here. Not time it spent here. So in this expansion that I was discussing, so this was the only term that we were actually looking at. This is what we wanted to associate the scrambling time with. And this is the amount of time it spends in the Rindler region. This is the term that describes how long it takes to actually get from the outside of the Rindler region all the way to the boundary. And this is subleading in LP. So this is a subleading term.
I changed my question like this. What is the difference, this expression, if we compare with asymptotically placed space-time, what is the difference?
Okay, so you mean for this particular, for the leading order term? The entire?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Expression
so,
changed in the asymptotically placed space-time?
Okay, so in asymptotically flat...
LP is the constant.
Yes.
So what is the change?
F double prime goes to is that F double prime?
Yes, this is F double prime. So you can ignore this as long as it's a non-extremal bottle. Just ignore this piece. So it's just these two pieces.
I think maybe the answer to your question. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so for asymptotically flat black holes, this is what you're going to see. Where did the picture go? Here it is. So for the asymptotically flat black hole, the effective potential doesn't have these kind of divergences. It just goes to zero at infinity. So that integral that you're doing, you're only going to be doing it from here to here. That's it, and that's going to be finite. Like it'll result in this term being finite and small compared to this one. And this term will look like, so beta will go like RH. It'll look like RH square over LP square, something like the entropy.
Basically, this expression does not change in positive complex space.
No, you can still use this. You can use this.
Just for?
Yeah. You see, beta changes for different types of black holes.
There are some confusion.
Yeah.
There are really two types of echoes. If you go back to that
yes.
Picture of the potential angle.
Right.
Yeah. So there could be echoes between these two.
Yes.
And there could be echoes between this angular momentum barrier. So this one, so of course, if this guy goes to infinity, then that makes sense. But then there is still these ones, that time is basically, that formula is always finite. And it turns out the time between this and this is also finite because it's a small time.
Yeah.
So yeah, there are really two types of echoes, but then there is one that, yes, it's like that takes a little time, but I guess you don't care about that. There is still this one.
Well, what prediction are you making for what we actually see from LIGO?
None. This is not, it's not nearly as well developed as you would need it to be to actually make any comparison with real data right now. And this is just supposed to be like a suggestion for how you would try to understand these echoes from a purely quantum mechanical point of view.
You mentioned the proper Planck length versus the other Planck length.
Yes.
So you're making a prediction that it is the proper Planck length?
Well, I'm just suggesting that, well, I'm saying that I'm not making a particular prediction on, well, I am explicitly stating that whatever this modification is, it should be within some proper Planck length of the horizon. I think that's all I'm saying for these sort of constructions. And when you do that, then you get an echo time that looks like the scrambling time when you do that. But if it was maybe somewhere further out, you'd like very far away from the horizon, then the time scale of the echoes wouldn't look like the scrambling time anymore.
The thing that Bob is looking for is that the spectrum holography, can you predict what the echo time should be?
I would say you could by looking at so it kind of it depends on like if you believe that, so if you have some state and that state says and you believe that state to be dual to these exotic compact objects, then you can and if this idea holds true, then you could actually determine the echo time by looking at these, and that would set a constraint on how far away those perturbations are bouncing off. But of course, that depends on the kind of quantum model you want to adopt. So I don't think you could necessarily constrain it.
It looks like you just have some decaying sine wave, which doesn't really look like the echoes were done.
Yeah, this is just sort of a cartoon.
But I think actually one point of maybe consensus is so the point that Benny was making, is you were saying that the perturbative calculation does break down at a scrambling time. So we don't really know what happens. And I think your guess is that it just becomes flat, but then the alternative guess is that maybe the
conclusion, all the tests needs to be small and it can be oscillating. So these two things do not contradict.
Yeah.
So from this geometric viewpoint, it looks natural that they will not happen, but if I look at it's not actual holographic systems or many of the systems. It's quite hard to imagine out of time or that period or some signals bouncing back and forth. So, for example, there are some well-studied holographic models where we can send massless signals and we don't see any revivals.
So when you say you have this holographic quantum system,
so very simple, like a smart camera, we don't probably see such.
Okay, so I think what I would actually say about that is, well, the SYK is a toy model, first of all. And it seems to capture the saturation of the Lyapunov exponent. So it captures that aspect of the horizon. But I would actually suggest that that's probably too simple of a model to actually capture these. And I would actually suggest that you should look at a slightly different Hamiltonian. So I actually have a suggestion for a Hamiltonian that you should look at. And the Hamiltonian, so the standard SYK Hamiltonian is just this product of four Majorana fermions, right?
Do you want to explain a little bit about this?
Oh, okay. So yes, so the SYK model is a solvable model in large N. It's a quantum model that's believed to capture many of these chaotic features of holographic systems that look like black holes. And this system is strongly coupled, and it the Hamiltonian for it, it looks like this, where chi is. Where chi I and chi j are anti-commuting. So this is a maximally chaotic system because it saturates the the up and out bound. So what I'm actually suggesting is that consider the case where lambda equals zero and consider the case where it's actually saturated. Lambda L, the Lyapunov experiment. That's 2 pi over beta. So I'm suggesting that systems that actually saturate this bound are describing black holes with smooth horizons. This doesn't describe any kind of black hole. This is an integrable system. And then the stuff in between, somewhere in between, I'm guessing that these types of systems are going to describe your exotic compact objects. And the reason why I say this is that you can consider a new Hamiltonian and just add an integrable piece. Just add. Add a quadratic piece. I think these types of models have been considered in the literature, I think.
Always more.
And you can adjust the relative strength between these two terms. So I So you have these two coupling constants, and you can look at their ratio. And as you make this one larger, the idea is that you're getting closer to an integrable system. When you make this piece larger, you're getting closer to these maximally chaotic systems. So I'm saying that if you tweak these in an appropriate way, you might actually find a system whose Lyapunov exponent is actually less. It's going to be here somewhere. And it's these types of systems that we should be looking for these echoes.
And I guess if you are in the integrable region, you don't have periodic.
Yes, indeed. So you can, this is like the fermionic harmonic oscillator. You can solve these equations exactly, and indeed you get sines and cosines. So it seems that looking at the relative, looking at both of these terms seems important for these types of objects.
So I was talking about a resonance spectrum, but I'm not even sure that you have any such thing. Because your cavity is kind of only there when it's perturbed.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that you perturb it and then it'll thermalize and then there won't be anything there anymore. That
I'm not sure what sense there is a cavity in your picture that exists without the perturbation.
No, I think there would still be a cavity for those kinds of objects. I mean, why wouldn't there be?
Well, you say something has to go in and destroy.
Yeah, well, yes, I'm
but
said
there
I'm.
Is there,
I'm
and then there is cavity.
So initially, when it collapses, you would expect the vacuum state to be resembling something like the Minkowski vacuum, but after you throw stuff in, it'll ruin those correlations, and eventually it'll just evolve into something that looks like these exotic compact objects.
So if you have a resonance spectrum, it's not going to produce a time series like that. That's just one.
Yeah, something more complicated. This is just sort of meant to be sort of a cartoon,
You're thinking it's got the echoes are going to be more complicated.
The echoes are sum over resonances. Mm-hmm. And this is one.
But this is also one thing that is part of it. It's not everything. Yeah, but still, I don't even know whether there's a cavity in the sense that I'm talking about. Yeah. So, in this case, thinking about this resonance spectrum, would be the characteristic frequencies highly depend on the initial perturbation?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what you mean by characteristic frequencies. The quasi-normal modes?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so the quasi-normal modes, I mean, just from this picture, you would more or less calculate the same way as you would calculate for an asymptotically flat case. I mean, like, okay, yeah, so you're asking like whether the frequencies are changing a lot, like whether the the frequency of the quasi-normal mode has changed a lot if I changed the turning point. Is that what you're asking? Or?
Not exactly. I guess that I'm dealing with Bob's sort of question.
Yeah.
He's not entirely sure, and you seem to have this idea that the cavity is only there after you throw the perturbation, right? So
yeah.
The way that the cavity is formed, it's probably highly dependent on the perturbation that you throw in. So depending on the perturbation, different cavities can be excited, and then each different initial perturbation would lead to a different set of quasi-normal modes of this object. Is that correct?
Yes, that is a possibility, but the picture that I had is that when you throw things in, it'll generate some sort of modifications. I mean, when you change the quasi-normal modes, if you're saying that where this boundary is going to change, right? Depending on the perturbation, it'll change it where this thing actually is sitting. And yeah, that could be a possibility, but I don't think that.
If you change the position of the wall, you can change the quasi-normal modes of the object.
Yeah, but the change should be, as long as it changes within the Rindler region of the black hole, you're still going to get this kind of log kind of description for the echo time for the leading order.
For the echo time, but I'm wondering about the
frequency.
The frequencies, yes.
Not sure. I don't think there would be that big of a change.
I think, and maybe there is a disconnect here. So I think what you're worried about is that the way you generate this, membrane is dependent on initial conditions. But I think maybe the way to think about it is like the way you have a phase transition. Like if you boil the water, of course the process of evaporation, like where the bubbles look in, and those are highly chaotic and initial conditions. But ultimately, when the phase transition is complete, then you have a different thermal system in a different phase. And I think that there are two things. One is how you trigger the transition from a classical black hole to a quantum black hole or to a fuzz hole. That could be dependent on initial conditions, but after the phase transition happens, then I guess you think the generic thermal state is where you end up.
And that would be where you would be sitting. It's the most generic thing, just depending on maximum entropy state.
So I think that's kind of the guess. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the transition itself depends on initial conditions, but after the transition happens, then basically thermodynamics tells you where to sit.
That's
kind of the hope. So we are kind of over time, and we did actually go over an hour.
Okay.
But so let's thank Christian again.